Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. What a pleasure it is to have Ann Hillerman back with us, as she has been, in fact, for all of the books. Did we do a virtual event for one? We must have.
I think we must have, but I don't remember. I'm trying to blank out everything that has to do with the pandemic.
Right. Well, in any case, she signed all the, let me put it that way, Ann has thoughtfully signed all of the books for us. And for those of you who don't remember, it was actually an event here at the Poison Pen for one of your nonfiction book. Was it Tony Hillerman's Landscape?
That's right, yes.
Right. And Tony had, as you know, left us, and Ann and I were talking, and I thought, why doesn't she keep doing it? And so, with a little, she did.
Everybody needs a fairy godmother like Barbara.
Even one that helps plot her books, right? But anyway, which one is this now? Which number?
This is number 8.
Isn't that amazing? Wow.
And I think it's number 27 in the series for people who start with A Blessing Way and go up through my books.
And I'm happy to say that HarperCollins has repackaged some of Tony's books, and we have them up in front. They've gone through a series of different covers. Many of you probably remember the ones that were really beautiful Southwest art. And then I think I've told you this, and for the biography up there, Tony Hillerman's Life, that your friend wrote, at one point when Tony was ill, HarperCollins came up with a fictional title and cover to sort of keep everybody in the loop. And I may be the only person, unless you do, I actually have a copy of it. And I'm trying to remember, what was the name of the book that actually published? Was it Sacred Clowns?
Yes, Sacred Clowns.
Well, then that's my right cover, it's called The Mudhead Kiva. That's it. And it has the same artwork that Sacred Clowns has. So I have all of Tony's books signed, and I keep that cover hidden behind my collection. But I did bring it out. Do you remember that?
I do. It was strange. Dad had been thinking about the book, and then he got sick. And I think Harper was thinking, they had started the wheels in progress for promoting it, but they didn't have really any information, so they just kind of made it up and figured, well,
right.
Hillerman is very flexible, he can figure this out.
Well, I think Sacred Clowns was a better title than The Mudhead Kiva, which never really did it for me, but it's the book that takes place in the Hopi village and is wonderful. So you've worked very hard to take Bernie and Jim to different locations, and a couple of them have been very good for fans of Nevada Bar because they're near national parks or national monuments or actually in them. The one about the Malpais, is the Malpais a monument or is it a reservation? Does it have any official park status? I can't remember.
I think it is the national monument.
I think it is,
yeah.
Too. So if you were to drive towards Santa Fe or Albuquerque along 60, at one point, I can't remember exactly where it is, you can turn up and the road will take you towards 40. But when it forks off to the right, you go through the Malpais, which is has a ton of volcanic ash and so forth and cinders.
Lots of lava. That was the setting that I used for Cave of Bones.
Right.
And it was really fun. My dog and I went out there and we walked all around. And again, it's just full of places to hide bodies.
Yep. So we've seen a lot of New Mexico, but in this book and also the last book, you took us over to the Rainbow Bridge. And that was your last book, in fact, called The Sacred Bridge. What a surprise.
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. But this time we are in Utah. And I wanted to mention before we talked about it, this is there are a couple of paperbacks. There's a man named Scott Graham who has written a series again. Excellent for Nevada Bar fans, but they're called the National Park Mysteries. And one of them is set in Canyonlands, and one of them is set in the Arches. And the most recent one that we've sold out of, so this isn't really a sales campaign here, takes place in the Saguaro National Monument down in southern Arizona. But he's also done Yellowstone and Yosemite and all. And the reason I'm pushing it is he writes for a very small press called Torrey House. And they can be very hard to get. And last month was Small Press Month. And I'm trying to support as many small presses as I can, because in many ways, that's the only way we're going to get a lot of new writers, because it's increasingly hard for a new author to break in into the big publishing companies. So, you know.
And I'd like to say Scott is really a wonderful, wonderful writer. So I highly recommend his books. And he's also a really nice guy. So it was nice to see him be able to make a living as a writer.
It is. And his character is an archaeologist, which kind of ties into, see, there was a segue here. It wasn't entirely. It kind of ties into the Way of the Bear, which A, is in Utah. B, is a national monument, which you can talk about. And C, archaeology and fossil hunting comes into play, right? Was
that's
that clever?
Right. That's right. Very good. Very good. So it was really after being stuck basically as my own company during the pandemic, it was wonderful when the Navajo Nation finally opened up to people like me from the outside so we could go and visit. So this was the first book in two books where I was able to actually go to the places I was writing about. And it felt so good. And I think it made a difference in this book too. When I first had the idea I first got the idea of The Way of the Bear on a trip that we did on Rhodes Scholars. Two of my Rhodes Scholar companions are here tonight. And on that trip, I had never seen the bear's ears, and they were in the distance. And we had this wonderful driver guide who explained a little bit about how that monument, the geology was sacred to so many Indian tribes in the Southwest and how it had always been full of controversy. And so somewhere in the back of my mind, I remembered that. So then many years later, when President Obama set up Bears Ears National Monument, I thought, oh yeah, I remember this place and I really enjoyed it. And then when there was more controversy, when the monument was shrunk, I thought, well, this is not only interesting, but it's even kind of timely. And the other thing that really made me think this would be a good setting for a story is that the Bears Ears National Monument is on the very northern edge of the Navajo Nation. So it made sense that if Bernie and Chi went on a little vacation, it's not too far of a drive from Shiprock, and it's not too far out of their jurisdiction. So I was able to kind of put on my fiction writer's hat and think of a reason that Jim Chi would have to go up there, even though it not official police business, but kind of close to police business. And anyway, so that was that trip that I took so many years ago was kind of the inspiration for this book. And then luckily, since the pandemic was over, I was able to go back to Bears Ears. And this time I visited a place I had never been called Valley of the Gods. And when I saw that place, I thought, well, gee, there just really has to be a mystery set here. It's kind of like a miniature Monument Valley, but it's really beautiful and full of all kinds of places where people could easily get lost and confused. So that's just what all of us mystery writers want, something like that.
It also has terrific petroglyphs, which are part of the plot. And last year we discovered, I can't even remember how, that just south of Winslow, not very, very close to Winslow, there is a ranch, a private ranch, that has astonishing petroglyphs. And it's down in a canyon. You have to make an appointment with the rancher, but it's probably 10 miles, maybe 15 miles from Winslow. You head back towards Payson and make a turn. And I just couldn't believe how fabulous, you know, they were. But at the moment, lots of the petroglyphs are way up high and even hard to see. And I remember somebody with us said, how'd they get up there to draw them? And we said, well, maybe there's been erosion. Maybe the river has dropped. And they were originally at ground level, but, you know, we've come down. But he's even got a little bridge. So it's not as far as Utah is the reason I mentioned this to you. And if I think of it, I'll stick a note in the e-news to tell you what the name of the ranch is, but it was really magical to go and see it.
Yeah. Well, when Bears Ears National Monument was set up, the archaeology was one of the reasons, but the paleontology was really another reason. A lot of fossils found in Bears Ears really changed the way that paleontologists looked at how species adapt to changing conditions. And I thought that was just fascinating. And I had never included paleontology in a book. So I thought, well, this gives me a chance to learn something new. And instead of, people so often associate Southwest fiction with archaeology. I thought this will be a little something different. But of course, I had to have an archaeologist in it anyway, because that's the rule if you're writing Southwest fiction.
absolutely true. But, you know, going back to Thief of Time, most of you read The Thief of Time. That's the book that Tony won the Edgar for. And I thought for a minute you might be, you know, using the same, I don't want to give it all away, but anyway, the same thing. So I thought it was great when you sort of moved on to fossils.
Well, Thief of Time was actually the book that inspired A Spider-Woman's Daughter. My very first book, I said it at when I took over the series, I thought it would be fun to take readers to places on the Navajo Nation that my dad hadn't used. And luckily, he hadn't used Bear's Ears, partly because it's not really on the Navajo Nation. But he used Chaco Canyon very effectively in Thief of Time. But he just uses the place where the staff lives. He doesn't actually take people into the ruins. So when I was working on Spider-Woman's Daughter, I thought, well, gee, thanks, Dad. You really gave me a good idea here. So I was able to use the ruins as part of my, and some of the things found in the ruins as part of my story.
That book drove me crazy because I thought you had to go from Santa Fe North to Farmington to get to Chaco. And Anne has them going south in a different route. And I kept getting out the map. My husband lived in Santa Fe for 32 years. And he too was surprised. But maybe 40 wasn't quite so busy then. Chaco's actually in some trouble at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, because of all the, I think it's oil and gas. Yeah. It's an interesting controversy. A lot of the Navajo families who live there have made their money with oil, you know, that's how they support themselves. So they, even though they are protective of the ruins, they also have to be protective of their own income. So it's not, I think often the more you learn about something, the more you realize it's not as simple as it seemed to be.
True.
And that's also what you want in mysteries, right?
So one of the things that you bring into The Way of the Bear is the difference in jurisdictions. We've had that in other, but this is a BLM. So tell us about the ranger, because she is the first law enforcement person besides Bernie that really gets into the action.
Yeah, well, I had fun writing about her. So when the book opens, Bernie and Chi have gone to the Bear's Ears area because Chi is going to talk to a guy who is a philanthropist, and he wants to make a donation to the Navajo Police Department. So Chi is there, kind of, you know, sweet talking him, and Bernie's there because she's had a lot of trauma lately, and she just kind of wants time to catch her breath. But of course, when Bernie goes out hiking, something bad happens, and so then they get in touch with this ranger, and the ranger. And I have to say, I have met people like this. Not everyone loves our beautiful Southwest. And this ranger is somebody who came from California and is missing green and missing water and kind of ornery. Yeah, it's hard to talk about mysteries because I want to say and then, but no, you have to read it.
You absolutely do. So Bernie ends up, we can say this because it all happens in the beginning, she's taking a walk and she falls into a trench that should not be there. And as she's exiting it, a truck appears on the horizon and chases her, and she has to take evasive action. Now, for me, the really terrible part of the whole truck scene was that Bernie is very proud of her new white coat with her beautiful fake fur white collar. And at some point in the chase, she recognizes it's making her a target, and she has to take it off and throw it away. And my heart broke for her. I mean, she was so happy. That was cruel. At least I thought she could have picked it up later, but no. The guy shot it, and then he stepped on it. So, no coat. Oh, dear.
I have to say, I don't think that's a scene my dad would have written.
No, you're absolutely right. But, you know, she was so happy kind of stroking the collar. It was cold and she felt good. You know, because it is surprising to people how cold the high desert can be at night. You know, I mean, we all know that. You can always tell the tourists who are freezing in flip-flops and shorts while the rest of us are wearing our puffing jackets and all the rest of it. I love it because we had an exceptionally cold March here for Phoenix. And you could really tell, you know, the people who came from the sunshine were determined to get it. And the rest of us were way, sweaters, all that good stuff.
Well, I bought a house in Tucson last year, and at my house, which is near Saguaro National Monument, the eastern one, there was like 4 inches of snow. Everybody was amazed, but just what you're saying, you could see the snowbirds who'd come from Minnesota who were just very disappointed. I thought it was beautiful, though. And now the saguaros, a lot of them have the clusters of buds. Yeah, it's going to be wonderful when they all bloom. I can't wait.
It'll be spectacular. But if you notice, the Palo Verde are completely confused. I mean, some of them have blossomed out. Others thought the hell with it, you know, and they've just put out their leaves. We had a terrific wildflower bloom. In fact, going down to Tucson for Left Coast Crime, where I last saw you, we went to Picacho Peak for the first time. You had to wait like 40 minutes to get to get in. And the wildflowers really were lovely. But you could see the same thing driving out Shade of Mayo. They even had lupin. So, you know, it was a gorgeous spring. But anyway, let's go back to Bear Ears. So tell us a little more about the history of Bear Ears, because you mentioned about Obama, but there was a back and forth about this monument through administrations.
Yeah. Yeah, there was, and it was cut back, and then the land that it covers was expanded. And one thing that also appealed to me about it when I thought about writing this book is that it's the first monument where Indigenous people also have a voice. There are 5 tribes that really hold that area especially sacred. They use it for gathering herbs, for special prayers, and so the government allowed them to be one of the groups that's actually in charge of managing the monument. So I thought that was really a good step forward. And in the other thing in this book that unfortunately is true is that the BLM is very understaffed. So it's hard for them. I mean, there's very few officers and huge, huge expanses. So it's hard for them to keep up with people who are stealing fossils or harvesting archaeological stuff that they shouldn't. So I try to be sympathetic with them. It's hard since I really do have a soft spot in my heart for law enforcement. But in this book, law enforcement was really not doing its job, I have to say. So I was able to talk about that a little bit in this book.
Well, Officer Manuelito, though, she's right there on the ball.
Right, right. Well, you know, this is the first book I've written where Jim and Bernie, my two main protagonists, actually worked together. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. I was not exactly expecting that. But, I mean, Bernie, after what Barbara mentioned happens to Bernie, after she gets, basically somebody shoots at her, she's very annoyed, to say the least. And so she's got to get to the bottom of this. And who better to help her than Jim Chi, who was there? And, I mean, he's not fundraising is not his skill set anyway. So he would much rather be tracking down the bad guys.
Well, and he's been promoted, if you remember, in the last book. He has been promoted to what? Lieutenant,
yeah.
Right. And Bernie did not get her promotion to detective. So that's caused a little tension between them.
You know, it was interesting. I was doing a talk like this, and afterwards I was signing for somebody, and he came up to me and he said, "How many years is Jim Chi going to be a sergeant?" Oh. I thought, well, I guess 50 years is long enough to be a sergeant.
Well, it would have been hard with legendary Lieutenant Leaphorn for Jim to have risen to, but legendary Lieutenant Leaphorn is spending this book in Hawaii, so it doesn't really come up. You did finally get him on a plane, didn't you?
I did.
That was pretty awesome.
I did, yeah.
Your dad wouldn't have done that one either. No.
Well, it's funny. I have a friend who is terrified of flying, and. There was one book Dad wrote where Leaphorn actually does have to fly, and he's very, very, very nervous about it. So I thought this would be kind of fun, sort of something apart from the story itself, to kind of give the characters a little more background. So my friend was telling me how she hated to fly. And she said one time she was on a flight, and the woman next to her grabbed her hand and said, "I would rather do anything than be on this plane. I know I'm going to die." And so instead of worrying about how terrified she was. She remembered things people had told her about, you know, nope, don't be afraid of flying. More people die in auto accidents, you know, all that stuff. And so she then turned on the advice to her friend. And as she said it, it also calmed her down. So in, is that in Sacred Bridge? Anyway, wherever that scene is.
I think it's when Louisa has to go to Hawaii and Leaphorn can't make up his mind.
Oh, that's right.
Whether he's going to go with her, and it goes like that. So, yes,
right.
It must have been if he's now in Hawaii.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so Leaphorn is sitting with a kid who's terrified. And so he puts on his substitute granddad hat and soothes the kid. Leaphorn is not, like Barbara said, not much in this book. But the book that I'm almost finished with now is a Joe Leaphorn book.
Really?
It is.
Wonderful.
I've really been having so much fun with it. And Captain Largo is back. They get to be like police buddies. And yeah, I think my father must have channeled some Leaphorn energy into me. But really, I mean, Joe was ready for the job. I have to say. He's full of energy and enthusiasm.
And you all now know there will be a book next year, which is really cheering for everybody here. So, because Bernie and Jim are away from home, they're in Utah, they are staying in a motel in Bluff. And I have, because it's about the only motel in Bluff, I have actually stayed there. So it was really the year before last, and I don't know why, but for some reason my husband was tired of Moab. And as we're coming down from 70 down through Moab and the there's a Colorado River waterway. There is a road, drops off 70 down to Moab, and it goes through the Colorado, which I think is even more spectacular than the Grand Canyon in lots of ways, certainly more so than Sedona in lots of ways. And the good news is you are at river level, so you get to look up like you do in Sedona, as opposed to the canyon where you have to, like, you know, look over the rim and hope you don't fall in. Anyway, he decided for some unknown reason that we would stay in Bluff. And so we did. And the only place to eat was the subway or the gas station. So it's not a big metropolis. And I thought it was fun to, you know, realize that Bernie and she are putting up with the same, you know. But there's a woman next door in a room in the motel who is getting ready to cater to some giant party. So she shows up with masses of food and drink, right?
That's right. Well, you know, poor Jim and Bernie. So here they are on vacation, and then this woman comes knocking on the door, and her husband hasn't come back. He went to somewhere to get groceries for their big party, and she's really worried because he's very reliable, dependable. So, of course, Jim and Bernie have to talk to her, and they try to calm her down. And then the next day, they realize that her husband is never coming back.
I don't know that the minute she reported it. This is a crime novel. The minute this woman knocks on the door and say, "My husband is missing," you go, that's it. Right. Well, I mean, you know, you have to have a body somewhere if you're going to do this. There are lots of other really cool things. How much did you have to learn about fossils in order to write this book?
Oh, probably not as much as I should have, to tell you the truth. But
I thought you did a great job.
Well, thank you. I did spend a long time. There's a really interesting museum in Bluff. I don't know if you ever went there. It's a dinosaur museum. And it's ironic because of all of the dinosaurs in that area. In fact, most of the dinosaurs in that museum are dinosaurs that were imported from China and Europe. So it was like one of those really quirky little things. But yeah, I spent a lot of time. There's a great natural history museum in Albuquerque that has a lot of fossils and a lot of really good explanation about the fossil record. And then I did a lot of reading. And I mean, one of the things that I didn't really expect when I switched to fiction was how much research it would take to kind of get things right. And then of all the time that I spend researching, how little of it actually gets in the book. So it's and how much more I would always like to learn about whatever I'm researching. But in a way, that's really one of the joys, I think, of writing novels, because it gives me a chance to learn things that I've always been curious about, and then kind of give the, besides giving the readers hopefully a story that engages them, also maybe teach them a little something that they didn't know. But the problem is there's always somebody who knows more about it than I do. So then they'll come up and they'll say, well, you know, this isn't exactly right. And, you know, you should have had 85 footnotes here to really explain all the intricacies. But that's how people are. You know, everybody's kind of proud of how much they know about something. So
why don't you remind us of what you did before you took up the Hillerman mantle and wrote these books? Because you had a long career of your own.
Oh yeah, I was a reporter, an editor, and journalist for about 20 years, and I really loved it. And I think maybe that's what gave me my affection for research, because you know, as a reporter, it maybe, you know, in a day, maybe you're doing three stories on totally different topics. And so you kind of learn pretty quickly how to find enough so you can at least ask intelligent questions to the person that you're talking to. And then after that, I did a bunch of nonfiction books. I did one on Santa Fe Gardens, which was really lovely. And again, involved, it was supposed to be a book about gardens, but it turned out to be a book about gardeners, because I found that everyone had such a different approach to gardening and knew so much more about maybe specific plants like succulents or how to cultivate native seeds in a garden. And I mean, it was really fascinating. And then when my dad died, that was when the Tony Hillerman's landscape book, the book that talked about the places he loved in Navajo land, that was the year after he died was when that book came out. And so I was doing talks just like this. And as I was doing those talks, I realized that besides missing my dad, I was really going to miss those stories. And so that was what kind of propelled me to take off my nonfiction hat and see if I could write a novel. And I have to say, I've had no regrets. I really have enjoyed it. And I'm hoping that I'll enjoy it for a couple more books at least.
Well, I hope so, too. And actually, being a reporter and interviewing people, I think, always helps an author of fiction write dialogue. You know, you get used to how people talk and so forth. And, you know, you've done a really good job with that.
And the other thing that helps is going to endless city council meetings, school board meetings, planning commission meetings, because you have to, as you're listening to that as a reporter, you have to really hear where the passion is and then select those quotes. And so I think then, of course, when you're writing dialogue in a book, it has to be like the poetry of language. You don't want to put down everything everybody says. You have to get to the nut of it. So I think that really did help me.
I'm sure it did. So I don't know if any of you read about the fact that the huge storms in California have recreated the gold rush. Then you see the photos of, you know, people like in the, some guy pulled up a nugget that was enough to buy a new truck. And, you know, there was a really funny picture of some guy like face down in the river coming up with gold. And, you know, fossils are extremely valuable. And I was fascinated to see that at a recent auction, a dinosaur that was put together from bones, unrelated bones. In other words, you know, they took a piece here and a piece there and everything and reconstructed this dinosaur. But it's not, you know, the whole dinosaur found in situ, so to speak. Right. And it sold for like $2.5 million. That was flabbergasted.
I think it was something like $8 million.
Well, maybe.
It was huge.
It was a lot.
And it was, it was interesting. It was a Tyrannosaurus Rex, who is like the most most prized of all dinosaur skeletons. But yeah, I thought it was fascinating. They could, a bone here and a bone there. This is the knee bone. This is the hip bone. They go together. I mean, I don't. Anyway, and then where would you put it?
I don't know.
Well, either a big house with an entry hall or a museum, whichever way you want to look at it. But anyway, the reason I brought it up is that you can see that if you could find like a piece of a dinosaur somewhere, it would actually have market value. You don't have to find the entire skeleton.
And actually, there is a lot of controversy over like common fossils, and you know, people selling common fossils, selling them to schools so kids can learn, you know, how mollusks developed or whatever, and then finding say among those gajillion mollusk fossils, there's the one mollusk that grew into something else. And so then scientists say, well, maybe these all shouldn't be sold, because what if there's that one fossil that has some kind of an evolutionary key? And it's interesting. I never thought of that, but I learned a lot writing The Way of the Bear, I have to say. The other thing that's becomes a factor in here is a condition called face blindness. And I hadn't heard of that until I had a friend who had it. And I say a friend, more like an acquaintance. And we were sort of in the same social circles in Santa Fe. So we'd go to these fundraising parties for Boys Club, Girls Club, for Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And every time I saw her, she would say, oh, hello, I'm such and such. And after about the 10th time, I said, oh, yeah, we met at such and such. And then she said, oh, well, I have to tell you, I have this condition where I can't remember people's faces. She said, as you're talking to me, I'm recognizing your voice and, you know, I'm putting it together with your name. And I thought, what an odd thing that would be. But as you know, every writer kind of collects all those little gems. And next thing you know, they end up in a book. So
I think it was Oliver Sacks that wrote a book about it called The Man Who Mistook His Hat for His Wife. Wasn't that it? Yeah. So, I mean, it. I'm sorry?
His wife for a hat.
Sorry, I had it backwards. Well, anyway, you know, and there's things like synesthesia and, you know, all kinds of interesting neurodivergent conditions that really make things interesting.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. The other thing that I found interesting doing this book was the whole idea of bears and the spiritual elements of bears. And so many Native people have high regard for bears, I think partly because they're kind of standing up there, kind of close to people maybe, or giant people. I don't know exactly. And also the bears are big warrior spirits and protectors. And I was thinking, as I'm writing about law enforcement people who certainly are warriors and certainly need a lot of protection, it just, the idea of having bears in this story seemed really appropriate. And the bears' ears themselves are looked at as kind of the protectors of that whole area. So it was quite an adventure writing this book. Oh, and then I have to tell you, something embarrassing happened when I was writing this book. So I'm on, like, I've sent it to New York. It's come back. I send it again. I make their changes. It comes back. I see more things that I need to fix. It comes back again. So it's like the very last time I can read it. And as I'm reading it, I'm realizing I have a guy who is actually dead in a truck 4 chapters later. Oops, yeah. And I thought it was so funny that nobody caught it. But I think readers would have caught it. And I would have had like a gajillion Facebook comments and emails. So I was glad I got rid of that guy. But he was really persistent. I mean, talk about life after death, man.
Well, once again, that's a reminder that the book you finally read is not necessarily the book that Anne started out to write. Books go through a big evolutionary cycle, and it's always, you know, sometimes I read them early, and sometimes I'm astonished when I sit here and talk to an author, and it's gone, you know, or whatever, and I think, oops. But that's, you know, do you enjoy the revision part?
I do. Actually, I enjoy it. But what the hardest part for me is doing the first draft. I really struggle with that. But I, you know, there are two schools of writers, people who write from outlines and people who just kind of wing it. And it dawned on me that actually my first draft is just kind of like an outline. And then I go back and take out I try to take out the boring parts and put in more of the juicy parts and, you know, build up the suspense and, you know, do all of that stuff. But I can't, with the first draft, what I'm really trying to do is just get the story set. And then when I rework it, I can add some finesse, I hope, and make it, I don't know. I always like rewriting a lot better.
When you are writing the first draft, do you know the goal towards which you are taking the story, or does it zig and zag and change on you?
Well, I know that Bernie and Chi and Jolie Porn all have to survive the book. Right. I know the crime has to be solved, mostly, usually.
You don't even know what the crime is when you start out.
Yeah, usually I do. Usually when I start, I know of the three characters who will be the main crime solver. I know the setting, and often the setting then kind of determines the crime. Okay. I mean, like in Way of the Bear, the crime has to do with paleontology. And in Sacred Bridge, the crime had to do with, the crime involves somebody who drowns in the lake. So, I mean, that kind of made sense. So, yeah, I know, I guess I have like the rough outline, but I don't have most of the details. And then as I start working with the characters, then stirs up my imagination, and then I have another idea, and then I go down a cul-de-sac, and then I come back to the second idea and see what else I could do with it. But yeah, I think it's the first draft. I think that's why it's so hard, because I don't really have I'm just kind of inventing it as it goes along. And then after I get something on paper, which is usually maybe 100,000 or 100 more than that, then I can cut it back and enhance the places that need to be enhanced.
So in order to, you have to stay within a relatively circumscribed area, and you're trying to dodge any of the places that your dad wrote about. So is your first job to figure out which landscape you want to use?
Usually it is, yeah. Luckily, there's so many choices. I mean, the Navajo Nation is
huge.
Large and beautiful. So there's, and even though my dad wrote 19 novels, he didn't explore nearly all of it, so... The book that I'm finishing now is set mostly in the Window Rock Gallup area. So, and I've used that area, but I'm able to go to new places that I hadn't gone to. So I'm having a lot of fun with it. After, when I'm done here, in fact, I'm going up to Farmington, and then I'm going to spend some time doing a little more research up there.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, we probably said everything we can say about the book without ruining it for you. So who would like to have questions before? I mean, I can digress for hours, but maybe one of you has a question you'd like to ask. Anybody?
I think Christine has one in the back.
Thank you. And it's about research. So is there anything in the book that you really wish you could have put in, or that you had to take out that you wish you could have kept in?
Well, yes. So in this book, there's a skull. And I figure, because the paleontologist is attached to the skull, he had to give it a name. So he calls it Mary. So I'm thinking, you know, what would be a good name for this skull? So I do research, and I find there are all kinds of women who were pioneers in paleontology who got very little attention. And so, I mean, I think people know about Mary Leakey, but before her, there were like a lot of women who really worked hard at it and just kind of got bowled over because they were ahead of their times. And I would have loved to have like written a whole chapter, Women in Archaeology, Things You Need to Know. But somehow it just didn't move the story forward, so I dropped the idea.
But a surprising number of them were named Mary.
Yeah, they were.
I don't know if there's a connection there, but I thought that was, because you do name like three or four of them in the book besides Mary Leakey, who, you know, were called Mary, right? Anyone else?
That's a really interesting question. When I started the series, I had a wonderful consultant. She was a woman who worked for the Santa Fe Police Department, who was a detective, and she was actually Hispanic, but she also had Native blood and Native connections. So it was she gave me a lot of good tips and just kind of insight into, you know, women in law enforcement. And then she applied for a promotion and got turned down. And then she sued the Santa Fe Police Department, and then she moved away. So now I'm kind of looking for another consultant like that. But it's easier now to find strong women in positions like that than it was when I started the series 10 years ago. And I'm sure it's easier now than when my dad started it back in 1972. I think that's part of the reason. I'm glad you asked that, because I hadn't really put this together. But, you know, when he created Bernadette Manuelito, she's basically a sweet, barely competent kind of police woman. You know, she brings the coffee. She drives Jim when he breaks his foot. But she's not a crime solver. And I think part of that was that there really were not a lot. 50 years ago, there probably were not a lot of good models of women in police work. I think in the military, there were more so. But, you know, things have changed, thank goodness. So it's not as hard now as it was when I started. And I need to find somebody else who can give me some good insights.
Does Joe Leaphorn have a major part or a minor part in this book?
In this book, he has a minor part.
Right.
Yeah. The
he's
question was, does
this book,
yeah,
right.
does Joe have a major or minor part? And he's a minor part in this book. You know, when I first started the series, I thought I have all these three characters and they all have to do something. And after a few books, I realized most writers, when they do that, what they do is take one of these characters and do another series. So, like, there would have been the Jim Chee series and the Bernadette Manuelito series. But no, I wasn't that smart. So now I have all three of them in one book.
Yeah, but you know, you made a good point, which is that you can vary which one is doing the lead investigation. I mean, Bernie has her mother and her sister to think about. And, you know, Jim has, now he's a lieutenant, he's pushing paper a lot. So it's not unreasonable that Joe would step forward and then maybe Jim, and, you know, so I think you actually got a good design there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I don't know, when I'm doing programs with, say, John Sanford or J.A. Jantz, and they have, you know, all of these spinoff series, I think, oh, well. But no, I actually like having them together. They kind of seem like a family. And since Leaphorn was the mentor to the two younger detectives, I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually never thought about your splitting them up. Did anybody hear? No.
Okay, thanks. No. I won't.
Right.
Have you ever thought of writing a book with a plot around the old boarding school at Fort Defiance, when children were taken away from their families, placed in that school, and Mr. could
yeah. This. There. I don't know if you all heard the question. It was, had I ever thought about writing a story about the boarding school at Fort Defiance and how the children were taken from their families and mistreated? It seems like lately that has been very much a topic for books. And so I haven't, if I thought about it, I'm not sure I actually thought about it, but if I had thought about it, I would have moved it to the back of my brain, because I think there have been quite a few books about that lately. Craig Johnson's new book focuses on that very much. But it's a good topic, and the book that I'm just finishing has to do with Native adoption and with Native kids before the law that said Native kids should stay with their tribes, being adopted by non-Native families, and a lot of the issues that have to do with that. So I'm interested in that kind of cultural disruption. I'm just taking a little different approach to it in the book that I'm finishing now.
You bet. I have an excellent plot idea for you, which I'm going to tell you over drinks when this is all over. I have a really good idea. Right. So who's next?
Yes, sir. Oh, I love that character. I have used him in books, but I haven't used him lately. So, yeah, I think I need to figure out a way to get them up to Hopi country again. Yeah, yeah. Yes, sir.
So, a question about the writing process when you were talking about doing outline. Do you write your book linearly, or do you write certain sections about characters and then move them around as?
Linearly, I try to. Once in a while, I come up with a section that doesn't fit where I've put it. So then I put it in a special file, and I wait to see if I can work it back in, or if it just needs to kind of live in that file until I die.
That's the beauty of writing on computers. You know, it was a lot harder when you were typing them to do that. It really was. You'd have a pile of paper over here, but then you'd have to redo the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Computers are really a gift to writers. But I think, on the other hand, they make it easy for people who probably should have thought about it a little more to say that they're writers.
That's very well put. Very delicate. I like that. So, anybody else? Ah, there's a hint.
Navajo women, though, read your book and see her as an example to follow, or does it matter to them?
You know, that's an excellent question. And yes, often when I do talk, say, in Gallup or Farmington, and there will be Navajo people in the audience, it's not unusual for, say, a Navajo mom and the grandma and maybe the teenage daughter to come up afterwards and want their picture taken with me. And then usually it's the daughter who will say, gosh, it's nice to see somebody kind of realize how strong we Navajo women are. So. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm really, it always makes me happy to hear that. Oh, I wanted to tell you, you probably know this book. It's a book called Shutter.
Actually, we debuted it.
Oh, you did? I love that book.
And that just won the Best First Novel Award at Left Coast Crime.
That's right. That's right. That's a wonderful book. It's written by a Navajo woman who went to the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe and also worked as a forensic photographer. And her character is a forensic photographer. And it's really thrilling. I like that book a lot. She's got a lot of, I hope she'll have a lot of books under her belt.
I think she's working on another one, but she did say that because of her... you know, her documentary work and all the rest of it, she may be a little bit slow. But there's, you all remember The Blessing Way, which might have introduced you to a lot of Navajo, what's the word I want? I don't want to say, superstition doesn't sound right, but thank you. Right. Okay, so Ramona has a woman who actually... has more of that, you know. There's a whole sort of slightly supernatural. Well, actually, why am I saying slightly? Supernatural element to it, and part of it's linked to her, the female lead's photography. So she sees things or whatever that not everybody does. Her name is Ramona Emerson, Emerson. We have some up in the front, and it's called Shutter. Yep. And interestingly enough, Soho Press started out its crime line years ago. They only did international, not American, books. And then one day, they took on an Alaskan author, and I thought, is that a statement? And now what they're actually looking for are cultures that are, you know, so the Navajo book would fall into that. They're still doing the Alaskan guy. And I like that they're focusing on, you know, cultures that we might not, that we don't run across as often in mainstream fiction. But I am hoping that, you know, the other thing that's going on right now, I sent out the e-news I just sent out yesterday had a link to an article by Richard North Patterson in which he talks in the Wall Street Journal for two whole pages about how difficult it is anymore for an author to be published who is not writing about what he or she actually is. In other words, you can't write about a character of a different faith or a different culture or a different sexual orientation, whatever it might be, if you're not that. And publishers have hired what they call sensitivity readers. You may have seen the controversy about rewriting Roald Dahl, rewriting Agatha Christie. If they ever get to Raymond Chandler, it'll be just ridiculous because, I mean, you could hardly read Raymond Chandler today without smoke coming out of your ears, but it's Chandler. Anyway, I said your dad would not be allowed to publish. If he started today, he would not be allowed to publish The Blessing Way. He really wouldn't under those conditions. And so I'm really, you know, I mean, I said that to Ramona. Well, I didn't say it to Ramona, but I'll say it here, that I don't know that her book would have made so much traction if Tony hadn't actually already created an audience for people to read about that. So I think we're going off the rails. You know, there's a lot of craziness from the right, and there's a lot of craziness from the left, too, you know, and I don't know how we're ever going to kind of merge again.
It seems like the whole point of fiction is putting yourself in somebody else's skin.
That's right.
I mean, for readers as well as writers.
That's right.
I mean, where would Charles Dickens be?
Well,
I mean, goodness.
Yeah. I wanted to, you know, Jen Sanford was just here, and he's been a number one bestseller for forever. I we work with him, and I'm always rooting for it because he's very competitive. But Letty Davenport, he actually sat here and said a couple of weeks ago that he has written two books about Letty, and it's not that he's under any pressure not to write about a young woman, but it's too hard for him to actually write like a young woman or think like a young woman. So he's probably going to blend her back into the regular series. So he wasn't being pressured to give her up. But the great thing was that he was free to write Letty, yeah. You know. But yeah. Then he's the number one bestseller. So who was going to tell John he couldn't do that, right?
Well, I haven't had any blowback from my publisher.
No.
And actually, I haven't had any. There's always snarkiness out there. But I haven't had any basic problems or controversy or criticism from Navajo people. And I think it's because, I think, first of all, my dad spent a long time building goodwill. But I think, secondly, because they are treated respectfully and they're heroes. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, a lot of books by Native writers deal more with social problems mm-hmm. than these mysteries do. And the characters, I think, come off badly. I mean, they may be realistic, but they're not particularly people I want to read about. I mean, that's probably just my own preference. Mm-hmm. I think when I read, I read for entertainment and to learn something new. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's so much tragedy around us that when I'm reading a book, I like happy endings. I think that's why I like mysteries, because in the end, usually justice is done and the bad guy gets his desserts and, you know, the good triumphs.
I really miss James Doss. Did any of you ever read the James Doss mysteries about the Utes? They were wonderful. He died many years back, and it was, you know, but he had very good cooperation, I think, from the Utes. They were pleased that he was writing about them and helped them. And Margaret Cole, you know, wrote about the Arapaho in her very long series. So,
and the Navajo Nation has been very supportive of the Dark Winds movies.
Yeah.
I mean, they were the Navajo Film Commission has worked with them, and so I think that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always going to be something, but I love these books, and I love my dad's books too. So I'm not apologizing for anything.
There's a lady over there who's had her hand up.
Oh, I was just going to say that I was introduced to yours and your father's books when I started working on the Navajo Reservation, and I, met lots of teachers and people in the and I have people repeatedly say, "Well, have you read our Hilleman?" And they kept telling me about, "Okay, all right." So they were the ones who told me about it, and the women were the ones who told me. So they just adore you.
Oh, well. Thanks.
Yes, sir?
I think we're safe with Anne's writing because we were present when the Navajo tribal chairman complimented Anne and called her Navajo. I thought that was great.
Yeah. You know, the only real controversy I can remember with non-Native people writing about Native, and if you've lived here a long time, you may remember this too, because it was all over the Arizona Republic. It was an author named Jake Page who wrote about the Hopi. And the problem was that in the packaging or so forth, they showed the Hopi, the kachina. And that was what just outraged. There was a tremendous thing here. But it wasn't so much about the books or the story. It was about the packaging. And I actually own all four of them, along with all of your dad's books, just because, I keep thinking one day I'll reread them. And then as publishing, there are 134 new hardcover books that I need to cover for May. I'm serious, and that's leaving out, a universe of books. So publishing is putting more and more books out, and it's harder to distinguish now which ones you really want to pay attention to. So my dream of rereading my library keeps vanishing. But I think it would be interesting to reread the Jake Pages now, all these years later. Let's see.
Is he still alive?
I don't know. I think he wrote for the Smithsonian. Don't I remember that he had some kind of a, I think. And so he was surprised, I think, by because he was a, you know, columnist or a reporter or something. I think he was surprised by the backlash that the whole thing got. But that's the only one I can remember that for people writing outside their culture managed to get criticized for. Anybody else?
Can I read a little bit? Would
of
you
course.
Mind?
No, okay. Of course I don't mind.
Okay, so I just, this is from chapter 2. And one question that people often ask me is, when are you going to have a baby in your book? So I'm going to read you this. Not only was the old sedan with a burned out taillight in front of Bernie veering, it sped up and slowed down erratically. Watching it drift onto the sandy shoulder, she tapped her brakes again and flashed her lights. The car slowed down, crossed the center of the road briefly, returned to the correct side of the highway, then went off the road again. This time the sedan stopped. She pulled her truck onto the shoulder a safe distance behind the car and turned on her emergency flashers. Another drunk driver, she assumed, and she took off her seatbelt. They were lucky no one had been driving in the other lane. After everything that had already happened, an ugly collision was the last thing she needed. The driver's door of the sedan opened, and a young Navajo man raced toward her, leaving his car's lights on and the engine and the vehicle running. She lowered her window. Yate, everything okay with you? No, ma'am, not okay. We got a situation. She read the distress in his face as he rushed to her truck. She was glad he didn't smell of beer. What's up? My wife, she's having a baby. Right now? He nodded. That's why I pulled over. We were on the way to the midwife. His voice vibrated with tension. Can you help us? Hannah says the baby won't wait. She nodded. She always kept a first aid kit in the truck, and she reached for it, along with her flashlight, hand sanitizer, and an all-purpose tool that included a knife and scissors. She grabbed the supplies and closed the truck's door. What's your name? Roper. I'm Bernie. Are you a nurse or a doctor or something? No, I'm a cop, but don't worry. I've had training for situations like this. She felt anxiety rising in her gut and ordered it to go away. She needed to project confidence for this man. So there is a baby in this book.
Actually, you know, I thought you followed through the entire birth process really well. I mean, all the way to when the umbilical cord has to stop pulsing, which I have to say, I don't remember. So, no, you did. I was probably knocked out. But anyway, no, I thought you did a terrific job with it. You know, Bernie delivering a baby. Yeah, it's wonderful. Well, if there aren't any more questions, we've come to the part that is always sort of extra fun, which is that we're going to give away a couple of books. Pat, what are we talking? Okay. I have to keep the microphone up. There's a wonderful author called Elliot Pattison, who years ago won the Edgar for Best First Novel for a book called Skull Mantra, which is set in Tibet. And interestingly enough, he actually introduces a Navajo character into it because there is a connection between the Navajo and the native Tibetans, and that was really fun. But he then started a series called Mysteries of Colonial America, and they are set back in the, 1760, and they have our Eastern tribes. So we're talking in a Native American shaman called Kanawago. Anyway, it's... he's done a wonderful job with it, and he has very nicely given us books to give away. So every once in a while, he sends us a shipment of books, and we don't sell them. We do give them away. Yay. So I have two of them. So what we're going to do is I'm going to have you do a number between 1 and 39, and we will give away, Original Death.
What did you just think of it?
No, you have to say it out loud.
Oh.
I'm not pulling it from a hat.
1 through 39. Just pick
17.
Up. Okay. And you have to be here because sometimes people don't make it and they get their book signed, but they don't show up. So you have to look for the number in your book We should have given you one when you bought your book. If we didn't, we fell down on the job. But in theory, we gave you a number. It's your number for the signing line, too. So is there a number 17? Apparently not. All right. You know what? Eight. Interestingly enough, that's the number most often called.
Is it? Here.
Really? Just mentioning that in case you want to, you know, in the future, finagle number 17. It really is. And I have no idea why, but people land on 17 all the time. I know. I'll try again.
How about number 8?
Aha. All right. So you are going to get original death. And then I need you to do that one more time. That is not 17 or 8. Called Eye of the Raven will be the other one we're giving away.
32.
Aha. Well, wonderful. I saw you looked at your number. So now you've got it. And I will get the other one to you. Right. So let's thank Anne for another wonderful evening. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.